Welcome to the Climate Brides podcast, where we try to untie the knots between climate change and child marriage. My name is Ritika Revathi Subramanian, and I'm your host. Join me as I speak with survivors, frontline workers, activists, journalists, and researchers in and from South Asia to unpack the everyday lives and resistances of young communities braving some of the biggest challenges of the 21st century. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts. The Climate Brides podcast is supported by the University of Cambridge Public Engagement Starter Fund 2021. If you want to learn more about today's topic, head over to our website, where we have full transcripts of the episode, a specially curated reading list, climate models and infographics. Until then, follow the Climate Brides page on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook to stay tuned and stay updated. Between July and October 2022, heavy monsoon rainfall caused devastating flash floods across Pakistan, unlike any other in recent memory. The floods affected more than 33 million people, killed over 1,700, and left hundreds of thousands without land and livelihood. Balochistan was among the hardest hit provinces. According to the National Disaster Management Authority, more than 36,500 houses were destroyed across Pakistan, of which 60% were in Balochistan. Around 800 schools were affected by the floods, 600 in Balochistan alone. The loss of vital infrastructure deepened pre-existing inequities, leaving children even more at risk of hunger, disease, and forced marriage. Joining us today on the Climate Brides podcast is Maryam Jamali. Maryam is an associate researcher at the Center for Water Informatics and Climate Resilience, where she explores water governance and climate change policy in her work. She is also an organizer for Madad Balochistan, an indigenous-led collective working with communities in Balochistan to build climate change resilience in the aftermath of the 2022 floods. Hi, Maryam. Thank you so much for joining me on the Climate Brides podcast. I am really looking forward to this conversation. To begin with, could you give us a broad overview of, the demography of Balochistan province? Could you tell us a bit more about the local communities living there?
It's really lovely to be here. So towards western Balochistan, there is northwestern Balochistan, there is the Pashtun belt that borders with Afghanistan. As you move towards the south, southwestern region, you will find Baloch tribes that come within the Makran division. So they speak a different dialect of Balochi. Then if you move even further west, bordering Iran, there are communities that speak Brahvi, which is a Dravidian language. Towards the east, you will find Balochi speakers. It's still like the province is still a very large population of Baloch people. Very few other communities exist, but there's just differences of tribes between them, linguistic differences. Where I'm from, we have had a lot of interaction with Jat tribes and Bhil community, Od community, people who may currently live in the Run of Kutch, we've had interactions with them. So even demographically, I'd say that even some of those communities exist here. So we have Dalit Hindus whose ancestors are probably from India, from Gujarat, but they're settled here now. But those communities exist in minorities since they have found better prospects in migrating to India in the 70s, in the 60s, like before the whole visa and everything situation happened between the countries. Largely, the demographic is Baloch. Even as you move towards Sindh province, it is largely Baloch.
Okay, and also what about like prevailing cultural practices? Are there any similarities between them, particularly in the context of marriage?
There are linguistic differences, but culturally, the practices between East Balochistan and West Sindh are the same. In the southern region, the Makran coastal belt, they are a bit different. Their marriage practices are different. I wouldn't say demographically, but I guess somewhat demographically they're different as well, because there's a large population of Afro-Balochis. So Afro-Baloch people exist there, and that's a whole other class system. And towards the west, there is more interaction with Irani communities, so marriages take place between them. There's more interaction with them. The Pashtun tribes, they have their own entirely different cultural system. And even as you move north, you are bordering Punjab, where there are Siraiki-speaking people. Again, they're entirely different cultural systems. But the common thing between all of them is that they all still practice child marriage.
Right, and I think from what I'm understanding so far is that child marriage itself is not a new practice in the region. And I think we will get into the specifics of it and also try and unpack some of its changing forms as we move ahead in this conversation. But before that, could you tell us a bit more about, you know, your own memories of growing up in Balochistan, you know, especially with the changing rainfall patterns?
So one of my earliest memories is from 2007, and it is of NDMA, National Disaster Management Authority, helicopters dropping ration packs in my village. Since then, it's been a long time. There has been a flood in 2010, another one in 2012, and then again in 2022. So it seems that the frequency and the extremity of these floods have been increasing. The area where I'm from, the Kutchi Plain area, historically, it has been a rain-fed area, but since the British colonized the Indian subcontinent, it was turned into irrigated agricultural land. So my ancestors migrated here because they heard that now this land is going to be irrigated. There would be what we call abadi, which basically means that this land would be cultivated. There would be good harvests from this land. So it has been around 300 years that we've been on this land. My ancestors basically dug the canals that we still have today to have a right to be on that land. And while that worked in those years, and it's not like we haven't had floods. If you look at the records, we've been having floods, at least the recorded ones, since 1940s. But they were never like this. And the frequency and extremity of them has been increasing, but the community resilience has been declining at the same time. So a lot of the people that basically have been living here since generations are now forced to think about, okay, now we have to go somewhere else. People who haven't even stepped out of this land have been confined to their villages, have maybe traveled 100 kilometers further, and that's it. They are now forced to think about alternate livelihoods. They are now forced to think about migration, and they are forced to think about their next meals, because when we're talking about climate change, it's not just floods. We were having a prolonged drought for the last 5 years. And recently, we lost our wheat harvest because it rained unexpectedly. We got hit with pre-monsoons that we never get hit by during this time, during harvest time. And the biggest challenge here is that the people in this land, they're small landowners. So unlike everywhere else in the world, where you have larger land, 2,000 acres, 3,000 acres, you're able to use high efficiency systems and everything. Over here, people have 1 acre or 2 acre to themselves. And most people don't even have that. They're just tenants. And these tenants exist in a system of sharecropping where they, along with the landowner, get a loan, buy seed, buy fertilizer. And so now we're not just faced with infrastructure being destroyed or displacement, but it's a food crisis as well. We are seeing malnourishment. We're seeing people having to choose between paying off loans and having 3 meals a day. So that has been the situation so far. And we've seen 53 degrees Celsius temperatures for the past 100 years. But the frequency of those temperatures is increasing. The time period of those temperatures is increasing. But there's no infrastructure to support people. There's still no electricity. There's still no clean water. People are still living in homes that are not climate resilient. And the most, I guess, frustrating part is that these people do not produce any emissions. They use solar panels because they don't have access to electricity. They reuse whatever single-use plastic they have. They use biofuel. They rely on cow dung to make fires. They whatever livestock they have very less of it. So they're not producing as much methane as those large organizations, large corporations are. Yet these people are hit with climate change the most.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you've brought up some very important issues that are also understood as dispossession, displacement, and forms of maladaptation. Now, these are experiences that we know, in a sense, are deeply gendered. So during the 2022 floods, Mariam, what are some of the challenges that women and girls were facing in your province, you know, in relief camps and also in their own flood-hit villages? You know, what impacts did the floods have on their access to, say, food, healthcare, and safety?
So, child marriage has been a very common thing where I come from. It's not new per se, but with economic insecurity increasing, people are relying on child marriage for basic things. There was a laborer from my village who had to sell off his daughter for 2 lakh rupees so that he could pay for his wife's medical treatment. And there's a lot of judgment around these issues. It's becomes a moral thing that child marriage is wrong. But okay, how are you addressing the root issue? Do you know why that man did what he did? And even when it comes to recovering from climate change disasters, or even in the relief phase of it, women are disproportionately impacted because they are now responsible for all of the labor. Packing things up, lifting things up, living on canal banks, making food on canal banks, keeping their children fed. They're responsible for all of it. And since agriculture is not viable, there has been an increase in women's participation in labor, but in horrible conditions. So since you're not getting anything out of your harvest, instead you're going into loss, men have stopped cultivating crop altogether. So now women are hired as domestic labor, but they earn less than 100 rupees a day for horrible hours. Like, they're working 6 to 8 hours a day, and at the end of the month, even earning 2,000 rupees is a big deal. And this is while they are having children, dealing with malnourishment, because obviously men, boys take the priority when it comes to food as well. They have pre-existing medical conditions that are not addressed because they are not a priority in their households, because we are dealing with gender inequality in Pakistan, but in Balochistan in general as well. From my own village, you have to travel to the next province to have access to basic medical health care. So it's not something that is that I guess is gendered entirely. Mm-hmm. It's that healthcare inequity exists for both genders, but obviously it's easy for a man to go on a bike to a city than for a pregnant woman to travel there and have her child safely. Mm-hmm. Even during the floods, we saw that women were using cloth, which is sustainable, but they had to wash it in contaminated water, and that was causing infections. They had the most interaction with water because they were washing dishes, they were cleaning kids, they were washing clothes with this contaminated water. So we saw so many women dealing with dermatitis to such an extent that a woman died of it. Dermatitis, something that is entirely preventable with antibiotics, with just basic treatment. In terms of pregnancy healthcare, we saw that because relief organizations weren't really looking into the culture or norms of the area, they were sending male doctors. So women were not comfortable going to those male doctors, so they resorted to having unsafe deliveries, and that led to a lot of losses. And a lot of these relief organizations, they weren't thinking from the perspective of women, because they don't include women when they're making these big decisions. So when they were sending out these medical packages, they included paracetamol, Flagyl, amoxicillin, all the antibiotics that you can need, that you might need, but they didn't include misoprostol, that would have been an incredible tool for these women to prevent hemorrhaging when they give birth. And midwives know how to use them. Midwives kept requesting them, but it just didn't get to anyone up top, because women's healthcare wasn't really taken into priority here. People were seeing it as just a medical emergency. Okay, it is a medical emergency, but women are still pregnant. They're getting pregnant as well. You're not stopping any of that. And it is insensitive to even suggest that, like, why are people having kids when there is a disaster? Well, they are. You can't stop it. So how about you deal with it in safer ways? Except that didn't happen. We didn't see anyone coming and interacting with our midwives. We didn't see anyone asking them what they need. Because what I saw was that midwives were champions throughout this relief process. They made do with whatever limited resources they had, but they tried to have safe deliveries. They, when they requested us for birthing kits, they were so incredibly grateful to have them, because they saw that, like, the communities that they were involved in, what this meant for them. This meant that the next woman that they were going to help with the delivery was not going to lose her child. Something as simple as a birthing kit that didn't even cost 1,000 rupees for us. But it was not considered by the relief organizations that were actively campaigning online for aid, were collecting donations and everything. But it seemed like people were being used as tokens to get donations, but then those donations didn't really reach the communities that needed them.
Right, and I think you actually pointed out quite clearly that the floods actually aggravated existing inequalities in many cases. And, you know, one important point that you raised was also how relief and aid were also driven by existing logics of gender. Now, my question to you, Mariam, is that in last year's floods, did people from, say, marginalized caste and class groups face more insecurity or challenges in the process of accessing aid and relief?
So we have a considerable Dalit population that just a few generations ago converted to Islam. So that population in particular, I saw, was the most vulnerable, because they were not treated as equal as the rest of the community, of course, even though it has been many generations that they've been living here. So these women were, their opinions about their bodies, what they want to do with them, were completely disregarded. And they were the most malnourished out of everyone that I saw. They, their decisions about migration, about trying to access healthcare, were consistently being questioned by upper class community members who thought that they know better, that they should be able to decide for them, that they're making unnecessary visits to the city for medical care, or that they're wasting money, or they are exploiting this whole aid process and they're becoming more dependent on aid. And that is something as well, that communities since 2010 have become dependent on aid, and it's unsustainable. Instead of building resilience, organizations rely on aid. But that unsustainability and that reliance was disproportionately blamed on Dalit communities than it was on other people. And socioeconomically as well, women from lesser socioeconomic means were suffering the most. They were having to send their kids to go and walk and fetch water, because if you don't have a husband, you have to rely on the kids. They were more likely to sacrifice things such as healthcare for food. They were more likely to sacrifice things such as healthcare for a wedding, because you have to have some form of social mobility to survive in these societies. And there is less of a caste intersection here, because the population is largely Baloch. And with the Baloch, it is common that people get integrated very quickly. It has existed for centuries that since the Baloch were nomads, whoever existed in those communities just integrated with them. Like Hindu communities in Dera Bukti refer to themselves as Buktis, even though they're Hindu, which is a concept that is very, very incomprehensible to most Pakistanis. But again, that does not mean that we have complete interfaith harmony, that gender minorities were not being impacted more. Yes, they were. They were being impacted more because organizations such as Islamic Relief or Al-Khidmat were largely catering to Muslim populations. They weren't focusing on marginalized peoples. Even gender-wise, nobody was catering to trans communities that existed in both rural and urban spaces. They were not paying attention to them. They were actively trying to ignore them.
Yeah, you're right. And I think these narratives have also been recurring in the different episodes that we've also recorded on the podcast, and also point out to some of the glaring gaps that need to be considered. Now, my question to you is, drawing on these gaps or invisibilities, one of the key focus areas of the Climate Brides podcast has been on the experiences of adolescent girls and young women who are vulnerable to early and forced marriages. And of course, like we've been discussing, there are multiple drivers. So for instance, across the region, we've heard how period stigma, for instance, or lack of menstrual health products have kept girls out of school. And, menstrual health becomes even more pressing in a climate emergency. So Mariam, can you tell us about some of your interactions with adolescent girls and young women in relief camps, particularly on experiences of accessing reproductive healthcare and, which in turn has played a role in, pushing them into early marriages?
We've seen that these girls, their voices were not being considered as much. Even when it came to period relief, there were organizations that misinterpreted local practices that were communicated by these girls. And there was a particular practice that my grandmother used to do, my mother used to do when she was a kid. It was that whatever is left when you create a fire, the ash, it's used to rub on your pubic hair, and it is said that that means that your pubic hair won't grow back as quickly. So that practice was misinterpreted as women are using sand and leaves as period products, which was, I don't know, it felt like people were on purpose trying to create something that is an explosive headline that would be sensational to people to pay attention. So there is that. The people were trying to talk over these girls, misinterpret their practices. In the beginning, we saw that a lot of organizations and a lot of people kept arguing back and forth between, should we give these people pads, should we not? Instead of going and asking them, do you want pads? Do you prefer cloth? Do you prefer, what do you want? What do you want in your period relief kits? Because reproductive health care and menstrual health care, it wasn't just pads.
Mm.
It was also, do you have anything, what we call a kammarband, a drawstring to tie your trousers? Do you want hair removal cream? Because a lot of girls were struggling with that. They didn't like having bodily hair, especially when the temperatures were 53 degrees Celsius and it was absolutely humid. These things were considered as luxuries, as things that these girls shouldn't want. In terms of generally what these girls were going through or have been going through in the process of climate change hitting their lives, they are unable to go to school because most teachers have migrated. They are forced to, their only pathway in life is marriage. Get married, have a kid. They don't get to decide when to have a kid. They don't get to decide if they want that kid. They don't have access to abortions. They don't have access to contraceptives. Nobody even bothers to ask them what they want. Instead, it's more about what other people think that these girls want, what these girls need. And I think that has been the most devastating part about all of this.
Yeah.
That in the process of relief and aid, their agency has been stripped from them, their voices have been stripped from them, and instead they are being used as, again, tokens for the rest of the world. Sensationalize them. Look at these young girls. They're having periods. They don't have access to period products. Therefore, we are going to do something about it. People did not consider the fact that young adolescent girls, or anyone from these areas, they're people. They're not a monolith. They're not homogenous. They, even socioeconomically, you can't divide them into three stratas. You can't say rich, middle class, poor. No, there are a lot of in-betweens. There are practices that some girls were very familiar with and others were not. Some didn't know how to use pads, others used them in their everyday lives. Some were more comfortable with cloth. And instead of organizations thinking about, okay, how do we decontaminate this water so they can still use this cloth, they were trying to force period products on these girls. But on the other hand, there was this entire period discourse on Twitter about how organizations are forcing pads on young girls. But that conversation entirely missed the point that when young girls are using cloth and washing that in contaminated water and using that, they're getting infections and nobody's providing them the antibiotics to deal with those infections.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, nobody's even bothering to ask them if they're suffering from infections. And nobody is even considering the fact that even if they were, they're not going to talk to a male doctor about having a vaginal infection.
Mm-hmm.
That is simply not going to happen. So, yeah, they were very, I don't know, the way people were dealing with relief for women in general was that they were all grouping them into these monoliths, that we have a universal solution for them all, and we will use that universal solution on you, even if you want it or not. It doesn't matter. This is all you're getting.
Right, yeah. And I'd actually like to pick up on your point on, the desperate urge to find universal solutions to seemingly universal problems. One such issue that is also at the very core of the Climate Brides podcast has been on early and child marriages. Now, most interventions have used a legal lens. They are very aid-centered. But what is quite evident on the ground is how early marriage is not just the cause, but also the consequence of multiple structural problems. Can you elaborate on a few of them in the context of Balochistan and the floods?
So, child marriage, in my family at least, I remember, or at least my grandmother has told me, her mother was married off at the age of 11. So, but the recent one that I remember was just a few years ago. It was one of my friends from my village. She has 3 kids now. So the institution itself exists because women are seen as a liability. And that is a belief that is considered all across Pakistan. Women are a liability. But in this region, because of economic insecurity, it's more like you have extra mouths to feed. You can't feed them, therefore you must get them married. And then there is also the fact that the bride payments exist. So you actually, you're not just getting rid of a liability, it's an asset for you. You are, it's the way you're safeguarding yourself. You have a kid, you get them betrothed, and you receive a payment, and it's money that would have been unimaginable for you otherwise. And it is entirely legitimate in Pakistan because we still don't have a federal law against child marriage. And we don't have a provincial law against child marriage either. Even if we did, there wouldn't be enforcement. But I think legal legitimacy makes it easier for people to get away with it. It makes it easy for people to be like, this is okay. This is perfectly fine. This is the normal. My mom actually wrote her MPhil thesis on child marriage in Jafarabad, and she went and talked to a lot of young girls who got married and how that was impacting their life post-marriage, how it impacted them as individuals as well. And in general, what does it do to the family institution? And what she found out was that these girls were getting married, because they were getting married earlier, they had health complications because of early pregnancies. They had mental health issues because it is not easy when you're marrying off a child to an adult man. They had mental health difficulties because they lost their children, because their bodies were not yet ready to bear children. They had to deal with the difficulty of being ripped away from their families, adjusting to a new one, and then building a whole other life. They were giving up on their dreams. They were giving up on schooling, giving up on any different life that maybe a teacher had talked about, or maybe they had imagined for themselves in any capacity at all. Their lives were confined to just motherhood, being a wife, and that's it. And even then, there were these young girls were responsible for domestic chores, things that are considered domestic chores, such as fetching water. They had cervical spine problems. They had arthritis. They had weak bones. They were suffering from malnourishment. They had anemia. And all of these issues, I think, they compound when disaster hits. Because then you have weak immune systems. You have these young girls that never have had access to any healthcare, post-marriage or pre-marriage, but post-marriage even less. And that basically became a life and death issue. losing blood during a birth wasn't necessarily like this can be prevented or this we can do something about it. It literally went down to life and death. Like some of them just couldn't survive malaria. Some of them couldn't survive diarrhea, infections that maybe if they had access to proper healthcare, maybe if they did not suffer from malnourishment, maybe if their bodies were not forced to bear four children before they had even hit 20, maybe we would have had different outcomes.
Yeah, and I think you make two very crucial points here, Mariam. The first is especially how early and child marriages have a long history in our own region. And there are various drivers, such as existing divisions of labor, especially domestic labor, economic insecurity, patriarchy, culture, among other drivers. And the second crucial point that you're making is that some of the consequences, as is the case with access to healthcare or early childbirths among young brides, is again quite gender differentiated. So my question to you then is, how have, you know, early marriages, as we have been reading in news reports as well as reports published by humanitarian aid organizations, how have early marriages turned into a means of survival or a form of climate adaptation, especially to the floods? You know, there has been a surge in the number of such marriages reported both after the 2010 floods as well as the more recent flash floods. You know, I was wondering if you could sort of look at what is the role of the floods in this decision-making process.
People are scared. People are very afraid. For them, climate change isn't just a new phenomenon just because people have just started talking about it. They've been seeing it for the past decades. They've been seeing it when there were droughts. They've been seeing it when there were water shortages. They've been seeing it when people up top were dealing with water shortages and how they were dealing with them. They saw it when water rationing was taking place. And because of when you're hit with a flood, when you're hit with such a large-scale disaster, your home is wiped away, it's rubble, it doesn't exist anymore. All of your kids have suffered through malaria. You yourself have suffered through malaria. Your livestock is dead. Your harvest is gone. And the next harvest might not even happen, just like just a few months ago, it didn't happen. In that situation, you are afraid. You are not just economically insecure, you're socially insecure. You don't really see any future, per se. So you try to deal with it the best you can. You try to create safety valves for yourself, measures that will make it easy if this happens again. And those measures for people who do not have access to education, healthcare, any of the basic necessities that you can think of, for them it is simply, how can we have a smaller family where there are less children, marry them off. They're not thinking, they don't have access to contraception or birth control, so they're not thinking in terms of family planning. No, it's more of, I have three daughters, okay, that is 2 lakh each. That can help me buy my livestock so that I can build my house, so that I can lay baked bricks instead of the other one, so that the next time a flood happens, my house doesn't fall onto my family. People are trying to mitigate the impacts of climate change is what they're doing. Except this isn't what they're supposed to do. They're not supposed to deal with this individually. This is the state's responsibility. And when the state disappears, people start taking things into their own hands. And this is a result of that. If people were starting to, we had a slow onset of people were getting educated, child marriage wasn't thought of as this only solution and only way of life for young girls. They were thinking, they were getting their girls sent to college. They were thinking about future careers for them. And then they realized that there are no future careers. There's no jobs. these girls don't have anywhere to go. They're not gonna get any finances into the house. And so the best way to deal with this is get them married off. You get money back. You use that money to keep the rest of your family safe.
It's almost
so it's seen as a necessary sacrifice more than anything.
Yeah, and in such circumstances, like you say, marriage does seem to function like almost like a security blanket. Would you be able to share more on the local political economy at work? You know, is there a bride price or dowry? Who fixes these marriages, and what are the exchanges?
So it takes place between the groom's family and the bride's family. The patriarchs decide it between themselves. Recently, the trend has been that it's based more on how much money the bride's family needs at the moment. That's the price that they will give. And then there's a negotiation about like the groom's family, how much they can actually afford. So that's the pricing system basically. And we don't really see any material exchanges because the poverty is too bad actually. And they existed decades ago, maybe in my great grandmother's time when their other material things had more value. But at the moment, it's money. Money is the biggest thing. It's the most important thing. It's what people are using to pay off loans. It's what they need when they're in debt. It's what they need when they have to buy construction supplies for their homes. It's what they need if they want to migrate. But largely what I've seen is that the families that are still involved in child marriage, where the families that are still continuing this practice, they don't have the means to migrate either. So this is just my inference, but the practice I think is more prevalent among people who do not have the privilege to migrate, who do not have the accessibility to any form of social mobility in the forms of jobs, education, healthcare, anything, who are at the lowest strata of society in these areas. The most impacted by climate change, have had the most deaths in their families, have like existing genetic conditions in their families. So the more insecurity, the more common this practice is.
So yeah, when you're talking about money, how much are these exchanges actually worth?
Ranges from 70,000 to 2 lakh. Beyond that, it is not necessarily affordable for a lot of people. They would have to sell their land to pay more than that. But there are people who have had to pay more than that somehow. But it does not go beyond 3-4 lakh as far as my experience goes with the people that I've been around.
Right. As an extension to that point, you know, in our previous podcasts on the IDP camps in Afghanistan and cyclone relief camps in coastal Bangladesh, one thing that kept coming up was just the very vulnerability of the temporary shelters, the relief camps. You know, as a result of increased pressure, a sense of urgency and high insecurity, early marriage or forced marriages were also seen as a means of survival. My question to you, Mariam, is what is the role and function of the relief camp in itself, you know, as a space for these transactions?
I'd say that, the lack of planning, that it's an immediate reaction to the needs. It's an immediate reaction, say, if your wife is ill and she needs like treatment stat and she needs to travel to a city. That's where like you have to make the transaction as quickly as possible and negotiate the prices. And in those times, you will not get the best price either, if you can even call it that. And these decisions are taken in haste. They're taken based on need. They're taken, what I saw was that they were between the relief and moving back to your homes phase. It was consistently taking place that people were marrying their daughters off. They were at least brokering these deals really quickly because they did not have food. They had lost their rice harvest. All they were thinking was okay, the interest rates are increasing. I have to pay back this agricultural loan, and I just lost my means to do that. My family does not have food for the next 6 months, so I'm going to do this. The aid helped. It gave some people security. They were storing food and everything. But it still was not enough for people who had crippling debt on them. They were the people who were not just thinking about sustenance but also about their future financial situation, and not just long term, just their short term future standing financially. So yeah, a lot of these deals were being brokered during relief camps, but because there was a lot of disease and a lot of, but I'd say that the immediate problems were so big, to a certain extent, they did take place as much as they would in, say, a relief camp in Afghanistan. Because as soon as the water receded, people were running back to their homes. Mm-hmm. Our relief camps weren't extended for a longer period of time. In June, July, the rains had started. People were still, they had not evacuated. Around August, they evacuated, end of August. They were on canal banks. And then in September, people were starting to move back. And there were still a few families that were on canal banks waiting for more aid. But largely, people were ready to go back home, ready to start their lives again. Yeah. So there wasn't time to, say, broker these deals as much in relief camps, but afterwards, it was very, very rapid. It was happening everywhere, and we have been trying to prevent it. We tried to support farmers in giving back their agricultural loans. This subject can't necessarily be breached directly, and we don't really think that it's right to breach it directly, because in Quetta, near Quetta, I've seen that an organization established itself, and it went to locals and started talking about child marriage, and suddenly nobody was coming to their learning centers. Nobody from the local population was participating in these big programs that they had arranged. So the strategy that we have been employing is that if we give their young girls if we give them the reassurance that they're going to have an income stream because of their young girls, they are less likely to marry them off. If we reassure them that we can help you pay off this agricultural loan, they are less likely to marry their daughters off. It is seen as a last resort. And that, I think, is a big development in the last few decades. I'm glad that things have changed, that it's not seen as like the first option. It's seen as the last option. And that says a lot about the region and the poverty levels in general, because you really don't have any other options. Anyone would think about this. Like you would think about land, livestock, what other assets you have. So these people literally don't have anything other than their own kids. And that is their only option. And it is reductive to just say that like everyone in this region thinks about child marriage the same way. I think that people have changed. I think their ideas around child marriage have changed over time. For some, it may not have changed at all at the same time. So a lot of realities exist simultaneously. People are learning and relearning at different paces as well. But I guess I'm an optimist in this way, that I think that people are really using this as their last resort. Yeah. I don't think that people are doing it on purpose as much as they don't have any other way.
Yeah, and I think, that's also one of the very intentions of hosting these conversations, you know, to understand and really unpack these decisions of early and forced marriages as not just emerging from ignorance or neglect or tradition. They are decisions made for the survival of the household, and which also brings me to the next question. In terms of who are these grooms in question, you know, what are the age gaps that are being reported between the young bride and her to be husband?
So most of our land is not cultivable anymore. So what people are doing now to generate that right price is that they're selling off their land. It's not cultivable for them, but maybe someone else will buy it off. Maybe someone else is desperate enough to buy it off, which has become less common because people have also realized that there is no hope for this land. You're not getting enough water. You're at the tail end of the canal system. So there is no point in buying this land. So that has become a difficult thing. That has also brought the bride prices a bit down because the general economic insecurity affects both the bride and groom's families. It's for everyone. There are a lot of cases of very, very young girls being married to very, very old men who have no other prospects. There is less of getting young boys married. So there is still a big difference. Young girls are seen as mature earlier than boys are. So it's still a 16-year-old getting married to a 25-year-old. Or in a 17-year-old getting married to a 23, 24-year-old. The age gap still exists, but girls are seen as mature as soon as they get their first period. And so while in some cases the age gap may be decreasing, the ages that these girls are being married off is not decreasing or increasing at all. It's still in the same range. First period till like 17, 18, they're married off. The grooms are, they're not, so the betrothal, the deal happens earlier and the actual marriage may take place after some time. So when the groom's family, like they see that their boy is either participating in labor or is earning in some way, then they get the marriage takes place. So not before that, because they also see that like with this would just be a liability to us because they're going to have a family. There will be more mouths to feed. We can't risk that either. So it depends on the groom's financial stability as well. That is a big factor in whether his family will get him married or not.
Oh, and so then do they also belong to the same region? And how are they managing to fund the bridal payments?
So there's a strange trend in this area. People from upper socioeconomic classes, they are in favor or they're more likely to get married within their kin, while people in the lower socioeconomic strata, they don't really see as like we have to protect our family from outsiders. So they're more likely to get their have intra-community marriages. So if someone is not the same sub-tribe as you, you would still consider that marriage. If someone is, we have some nomads that come into the area during winters from mountainous regions of Balochistan. Sometimes marriages take place like that as well, between communities that are seasonal migrants and communities that are already settled there. But people generally do prefer getting married within their kin, but people from lower socioeconomic strata are more likely to consider marrying outside than people from better financial means.
Okay, and then as an extension to just that question, what are the prevailing marriage practices in the region?
So polygamy is still prevalent, but it's frowned upon if you have a wife and you get married to a kid. So that at least is like, I guess that is one preventative measure that is there. Other than that, polygamy is pretty common. Everyone has like 2 to 3 wives and it's not seen as anything that's frowned upon at all. Other marriage practices, we have vatta satta, which is basically like exchange marriages. We also have like marriage in place of blood money. So if someone kills another person, there is no involvement of law enforcement there. It's just a decision taken between the tribal leader and they talk to both sides and it is decided whether they're going to play, they're going to pay blood money, or they're going to give off one of their girls in marriage. There is also the practice of even in this context of, like, if there's a murder that takes place, sometimes they someone might say that the child of this woman will be mine. So the next child in your family is going to be ours. Is like the, that's how they negotiate these deals, sort of, that negotiate justice, I guess.
So, you know, one of the key issues you brought up earlier was the provision of and access to relief and aid during extreme weather events. In this framework, how does early marriage fit in, and you know, how do you imagine or reimagine climate resilience?
I'd say just that the phenomena of aid that people have been relying so much on, that they think is the only way to deal with the issues around climate change, especially climate change induced disasters, even things such as child marriage, that they see aid as the only solution, except they don't realize the unsustainability of it and how much it impacts communities in the long term and how much it impacts their ability to become resilient in the face of these challenges. Because in 2010, every aid organization that I could possibly think of showed up. But then Pakistan was put on the FATF grey list, and that meant that in 2022, there were no organizations. And what that meant was that people did not have the chance to come up with the measures that would have made them more safe, protected them, because they thought that these organizations would be there, that they would provide aid, that there would be someone. Even I personally thought that Madad was just going to be, we're going to provide relief to as many people as possible, and then the government is going to step in. And then the first week passed, and then the second, and the third, and the fourth, and then it was the first month, and the second month, and the third month. And now it's a year later, and nobody stepped in. And that is something that, like, even communities still don't realize, that nobody's going to step in for them. Because at some point, someone did step in the past, and they gave a lot of aid, more than was needed. And so it created this dependence, except the very organizations, the very people that communities are dependent on, they are, they exist within the boundaries of red tape and pre-needs assessments, and whether their organization has been approved or not, whether they have this paperwork cleared or not. And that, I believe, is the limitation of aid. It doesn't do anyone any good. It is a short-term solution, but and it is very easy to give aid rather than build resilience. It's very easy to throw money at people. It's very easy to compromise their dignity, their respect, for and make them pose for pictures for an aid package that is worth less than $10. And I think that's what organizations take advantage of, but they don't realize what it is doing. And it is only going to get worse. Climate change is only going to get worse. It's not uphill from here at all, as we're seeing it. And so they need to realize that the whole development model needs to be reorganized. It needs to change. It needs to go away from all of its values, all of its principles, where it stands, from treating communities as homogenous to sending them aid, unprecedented amounts of aid, and sending universal packages of aid everywhere without considering community needs, without considering specific community vulnerabilities, without considering norms, culture, anything of that sort. And while I can't dismantle the entire development model, I think that I can convince people that aid organizations are not everything. NGOs are not everything. Community organizations are. Grassroots organizations are. You can support communities directly. There are ways to do it.
So we are nearing the end of this conversation, and I thought it would be helpful to circle back to where we began probably to the very basics. In terms of what is the vocabulary that is used locally to explain climate change, you know, especially from your grandmother's generation to the present day, what exactly has been the vocabulary at work locally? Is there any communal definition, or, you know, how is it really perceived locally or expressed locally in terms of a phenomenon? And I ask you this especially because you work so closely on the ground. You know, what are some of the ways in which you break down the idea of climate change when you engage with communities who are actually experiencing the consequences of it firsthand?
They see it in terms of how their quality of life is changing. So they see it in terms of, well, I haven't seen weather like this in 10 years. That's strange. That this isn't, what we're experiencing right now wasn't happening before. So it is in terms of our reality is changing. They don't necessarily know that, like, who is responsible for this, or the carbon cycle or emissions or anything, but what they know is the weather is changing, and the frequency and extremity of these large-scale events that they're used to a certain extent is changing as well. Floods are becoming more frequent, droughts are becoming more frequent and worse, and they see it in terms of when is the next disaster going to strike. And it seems like the time period, the window is closing down on us. In Urdu, we call it mausam tabdeel ho raha hai. And I don't think we have a particular translation for it in Balochi per se, but people are still experiencing it. And even if they can't describe it as perfectly as climate change, they are seeing it as change. They are seeing their lives transform, and not in a good way. So in conversations as well with farmers, with the students that we support, we do talk about climate change. We talk about we don't talk about it directly, like how has climate change impacted your life, but more so, how was your life a few years ago and how is it now? Have you seen a considerable difference? What, in general, like what has been life like for you in the past decade or so, or whatever frame of reference you would like? So that is how we look at these issues. And sometimes it is in terms of, oh, the temperature is getting worse. Sometimes it is in terms of, we're not getting enough water. Sometimes it is in terms of, the harvests are not good anymore. But it is still climate change, even if they're not using the words for it. And I think here, communities, this is where, I guess, communities are at odds with larger organizations, because climate change is a buzzword. We love using it. We love using it when we want a new infrastructure project. We love using it when we want a loan. We love using it at COP27 when we're talking about billions of dollars of loss and damage. We see it in policy reports. We see it everywhere, all around us. There's paper straws in Nestle juice packs, and there's a new wave of eco-friendly packaging in Pakistan. And I don't know. I think that bit disconnects people from our realities when it's just a buzzword. Except it's not a buzzword for us. Even if we don't use that word like you do, it's still something. And it is it's a larger phenomena than you think. It's beyond eco-friendly packaging. It's beyond getting loss and damage approved at COP27. It is beyond including climate change in your policy documents. The phenomena, just because you have a word for it, people are using climate change as a scapegoat for governance failures. People are using climate change as a scapegoat for their failures in general. Political failures, socioeconomic failures, planning failures, everything. They're attributing it to climate change. And at the same time, like the cognitive dissonance of it all is that they're not even talking to the people impacted by climate change. So you want a conversation, you want dialogue, as people say, but you don't want it actually. Because if you did, you'd be reaching out to communities. Instead, it's an echo chamber between policy makers and leaders on global platforms, talking back and forth to each other, repeating the same jargon, the same plans, and it never translates anything down. People think it's a trickle-down process. It's not. It's an echo chamber.
Right, we are nearing the end of this conversation, and I need to ask you this, that, you know, you've hit the ground at a very young age. You know, what is the space like for climate activism in Pakistan, especially for young people like yourself?
So there is very little space here for activism. People are trying, but they're afraid. There's also the fact that the local politics that involves large landowners, that involves tribal heads, they don't really like organizations such as Madad coming in and supporting people, because that means that their voters get to know that they have a right to these things rather than seeing them as luxuries and a blessing from the ministers. And so that part is a bit complicated, and we've seen it, we've seen people trying to diminish our efforts, trying to counter them in that way at least. From the communities themselves, they are just glad that someone is there for them. This has led to, at least in my opinion, a rise in young voices trying to do something about things. Because I started this as a 19-year-old. I had to miss an exam because I was busy organizing flood relief. And so I think that me being young and connecting with young people like myself, even if they're from rural regions, even if I'm more privileged and I recognize that privilege, I am glad to be there for them. And I am glad that I get to equip them with as many resources as possible. And there are a lot of negative aspects to this entire conversation, but one of the best things that has happened throughout our work with Madad has been that we saw local efforts of community members organizing schools because their actual government schools were still flooded. We saw kids organizing trips to heritage sites. We saw kids talking about climate change, organizing speech competitions in their villages, and trying to make sure that people around them also know about this phenomena that is impacting everyone. And that has been one of the very few positive aspects of this work, that there is surprisingly still some hope that even if I at the moment am disappointed or frustrated, there are so many members of this community that are still trying, that are determined to try, that are fighting the state essentially, even if it means that they have to build up all the courage in their lives to do it.
Right, absolutely. And on that note, we come to the very end of this episode. It's been a real learning experience just talking to you about your work, lived experiences, and crucial insights. Thank you so much, Mariam, for speaking with me on the Climate Brides podcast. You and the community at Madad are doing some important and very meaningful work. So thank you.
Bye.
The Climate Brides podcast is supported by the University of Cambridge Public Engagement Starter Fund 2021. If you want to learn more about today's topic, head over to our website, where we have full transcripts of the episode, a specially curated reading list, climate models, and infographics. Until then, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. Follow the Climate Brides page on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to stay tuned and stay updated.